From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. It's always a pleasure to have old friends do the show, especially old friends who are, as of today, newly minted Oscar nominees. Of course, I'm talking to our old friend Ariane Phillips, who's got a bunch of these things under her belt. This time for the Quentin Tarantino 9th film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Always good to have you here. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you so much for asking me.
My pleasure. And what's really interesting, it's so much to talk about here, obviously, but I think of your stuff as being about costuming people who are trying to figure out their comfort level with their clothes, which becomes a way of communicating their comfort level with themselves. And there is probably no better sort of exemplar of that than Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where just the difference between DiCaprio and Brad Pitt, we get to see who they are and their comfort level in their lives based on what they're wearing, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing about costumes is they're really part of the storytelling tools on the visual side. We give visual clues. And the job is really, you know, costumes are about creating character and helping underscore tone and feeling and move the story along. And in terms of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I have yet to read a script like this where the characters were so well-defined. You know, often scripts are skeletons. And, you know, with Quentin, it was unlike any script I'd ever read before. And the characters are beautifully developed, which just kind of raises the bar for me as a costume designer to help underscore who the characters are and help tell this story and underscore tone and feeling.
Yeah, but I do want to get back to that too, because this is also about a time where comfort became the way people dressed rather than being dressed in kind of costumes or uniforms to set who and what they were. So you're actually able to fold in that level of sort of who these people are and how they feel about themselves in these clothes in a way that you really hadn't before. In Hollywood in 1969, when the movie apparently set, that idea of people wearing costumes on the streets even was starting to happen too in a way that we hadn't seen before. So you had a big area to play with along those lines, didn't you?
Absolutely. And, you know, intrinsically in the center of the script is really about a changing culture, a time and place, and Rick Dalton being an actor who finds himself in 1969 out of time and out of place and on the way to being redundant, and Cliff Booth.
Oh, he's well past that.
I'm being kind.
Spoiler alert.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the most important things, the challenges and what I really took to heart when reading the script was to be able to show this changing culture. So, for instance, denim. At that time, we know there are dress codes. You couldn't go to school in a pair of jeans, let
alone... Or Musso and Frank.
Exactly. Well, Cliff Booth, he wears denim to Musso and Frank's because he's a badass. And, you know, there's a lot of mystery around at his background. But absolutely, and like, we see Cliff Booth wearing denim as an extension of workwear.
But also, yeah. It's a thing where you have a grown man in his 40s, wearing a T-shirt, which was a really unusual thing to see in the streets of anywhere in 1969.
Sure, he's a stuntman. He dresses for comfort. You know, he's thrown off buildings. He's racing cars. He's run horses. And denim is workwear. And then I used denim heavily with the Manson family, which was, you know, part of the youth movement and how kids were repurposing clothes that maybe was, you know, in terms of dress codes, you know, it was breaking rules by wearing jeans and cutoffs.
Which was workwear, but also weirdly an influence of the movies, because the people who generally wore denim were in movies playing cowboys.
Right.
So that was even a way that movies had filtered into the culture in a kind of a really a subconscious way almost.
For sure. And being able to show how denim was used with the Manson family, how they definitely wouldn't have been able to walk into Musso and Frank's or Disneyland for that matter, as we know that dress codes and the way you wore your hair and everything. So being able to show also, and with the youth culture movement, you know, you're right, how people started wearing clothes in a different way, more a level of comfort and less kind of uptight dress codes that you would have seen in the early 60s. So this afforded me a lot of ability to tell that story, whether it was the scenes in Musso and Frank's or Hip Hollywood at the Playboy Mansion or Spahn Ranch. So there were so many wonderful opportunities for me as a costume designer to express what was happening kind of culturally and, you know, what was relevant at the time and important to tell that story in a cross-section with young hip Hollywood, you know, with Polanski and Mama Cass and Sharon Tate, J.C. Breen. They're also dressing in a very different way than the Mansons, perhaps, or, you know, people you'd see at Musso and Frank's, more sophisticated, more European influence, more reflective of what was fashionable at the time. So it was a real treasure trove of riches for costume design.
We're talking about a treasure trove with our old friend and new Oscar nominee, Ariane Phillips, costume designer of, among other things, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's The Treatment. But I guess I find myself thinking about this because as pleasurable as this assignment was, it must have been, it also struck me as being one of your more difficult because it was so factionalized. I mean, you could be in a room and have so many different kinds of outfits on as compared to other films you made.
Well, the joy was being able to work on a film about Hollywood and to be able to have the costumes, all the costumes that, you know, being able to recreate the TV shows and the movies, you know, from the 14 Fists of McCluskey to the Green Hornet. And, you know, as a costume designer, there's many times, all the time, when we have stuntmen on set who are doubling the lead actor. And they're, you know, nothing I love more than seeing a stuntman in the same costume as the lead actor with a lousy wig on walking around. And we actually got to show that on camera in this movie. So that was super fun. And I feel like this is Quentin's most reportage film. I mean, there's an emotional quality in this film. People have referred to it as a memory film for Quentin that was really special. And I also felt kind of as new to the Tarantino fold that this is my first movie with Quentin, that I had a kind of responsibility to the fans, of which I am one, to infuse that Tarantino vernacular, if you will, that Tarantino unimitatable style that we get from his filmmaking. You know, like when I read the script and it had Cliff Booth in a Hawaiian shirt, that's part of Quentin's vernacular, right? We've seen Hawaiian shirts in his film and in other films and other characters. And the great thing about Quentin is that he, you know, when we had our meetings about, you know, for instance, the Hawaiian shirt, he said, look, you know, what color it is, what the motif is, that's up to you. You know, let's discover what that Hawaiian shirt is. And, you know, it's amazing to have to work with a director who has a point of view, which seems like obvious for a director, that's their job. But oftentimes they don't have the vernacular for costume and for clothes. And so they don't even want to talk about it. Quentin loves talking about costumes and signs. Like, you know, we had a lot of great signage in this film. So, you know, he had very specific costumes that he mentioned in the script, like the Hawaiian shirt, Cliff's Hawaiian shirt. And he said to me, look, you know, if I wrote it in the script, I mean it, which is really unusual. Like when I've read scripts in the past where it says, like, for instance, like a red dress, usually 80% of the time, the director is like, I wrote a red dress, but I don't necessarily mean a red dress. We'll figure it out. With Quentin, it was quite the opposite. And he said, if I wrote it, I mean it. And so when we have our fittings, you know, I expect to have that Hawaiian shirt there, what it looks like. I'm not sure what the motif, what the color is. And he said, but if you have other ideas in general, bring your ideas to the plate. And that's the ultimate invitation for a costume designer, to be able to have a director who has a specific point of view and then invites you to surprise him, to bring something that maybe he hadn't thought of or hadn't occurred, you know, and that is the ultimate in collaboration and was one of the most joyful experiences working with Quentin.
I guess as you're talking about this, I find myself thinking too about what it must have been like to work with Quentin and to also know that his costume has become part of American cinema iconography.
For sure.
And so that's got to be something.
Oh, it's daunting. And also, you know, stepping in the shoes of some of the greatest costume designers, Betsy Hindman, who did Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, Anna Shepherd did Inglourious Basterds. These are designers I really admire and have influenced and inspired me. Courtney Hoffman, who did Hateful Eight. So it feels like almost like a responsibility. One of the things that I had fun with, and Quentin was game and we had fun together with, was the scene with Bruce Lee and Cliff on the Green Hornet set when they have this fight. And one thing that I really loved about the scene is, you know, when stuntmen fight, it's like a dance. And Cliff is wearing the double costume of what Rick is wearing on the Green Hornet. So he's wearing his stunt costume. Initially, Quentin had written a safari suit and a really bad wig. And as we developed further in prep, Quentin decided to change it and to a tuxedo, which I loved. Or his, you know, we had many discussions about what that costume would be that Rick had and that Cliff doubled. And so the great thing about the tuxedo, Bruce Lee is wearing his famous chauffeur jacket and he takes it off and he's wearing a white tank top and black pants and black gloves.
Which is also another kind of iconic Bruce Lee outfit, the white undershirt.
Exactly. And I was inspired to homage, if you will, the scene in Pulp Fiction with John and Uma dancing. Because for me, stuntmen are like beautiful dancers when they're fighting. And so that was like a Tarantino moment where I felt that I could infuse kind of the vernacular of who Quentin is as a director. And in the end was, you know, very happy with it.
I mean, it's got to be great for you because getting to do so many different kinds of things, but also to basically elite the line of distinction between the real world and the movie world sounds like a really exciting thing for me to do because you're also asking the audience to sort of step in and out, and you've got to do that in visual terms and bold strokes very quickly, but not in a way that makes these things seem costumey, because that moment you just described could be really over the top in a way that makes me like, oh, yeah, it's obviously a movie moment trying to be a movie moment. But you've got to bring nuance to it rather than just size, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just really the genius also of all the players. Bob Richardson's incredible cinematographer.
Robert Richardson.
Yeah. And
another part of the longtime part of Quentin's team.
Absolutely. Barbara Ling, who's a newbie like I am, who's a production designer. And, you know, how we can help, you know, illustrate this world, this incredible world that Quentin has so beautifully written in this script, and that balance of telling that story together, how it's shot, what the sets are like, and how the camera's moving through them. So it was a dream, really. And I also happen to, you know, as a costume designer, there's a lot of people who work with me in my department. If you imagine a costume designer like a director, then the first person I hire is a costume supervisor who's like the producer of the costume department. And I had been waiting for 10 years or trying for 10 years to work with this woman, Linda Foote, who's just the best costume supervisor out there, and was able to have her work with me in this movie. So she ran a great ship. I had some amazing people working, and we had to be quite nimble because we had so many speaking parts and so many sets. I think there were 120 sets, and I think we had over 130 speaking parts. So that meant that new things were happening every day, whether it was a location or an actor, and being able to switch between those worlds of the behind the scenes, you know, world of like Lancer and Bounty Law and 14 Fists of McCloskey and all the hullabaloo. That was super fun day with Leo singing on set. When we got to do that with Tony Basil, by the way, can we just like say Tony Basil, one of the most legendary dancer choreographers in Hollywood, who was our choreographer.
Clearly a lot to talk about. I'm thrilled. Let me congratulate Ariane Phillips on her newest Oscar nomination. Of course, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Yeah. Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. We're talking about the line between glamour and the real world from the set of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with its costume designer, Oscar nominee, Ariane Phillips. I guess as we talk about this stuff, though, you reminded me that this year's costume nominees, so many of them, are movies about guys. And that's really interesting. There's so many of these, there's not a whole lot of pretty dresses in the nominees this year, right?
Yeah, you know, it's encouraging. I mean, it's encouraging to see a film like The Joker, Jojo Rabbit, The Irishman being acknowledged for costumes, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Traditionally, there's a lot of pretty dress movies that, you know, and I'm not slighting Little Women. The costumes are gorgeous in that movie. But usually the nominees and costume designers, we nominate ourselves. So we have no one to blame but ourselves. But oftentimes we acknowledge the pretty dresses, exactly. So it's really exciting to see the diversity of costumes. I wouldn't say the diversity of story necessarily or female characters. You know, we need to see more of those in the future. But, you know, just in terms of the types of design that have been acknowledged. And, you know, I really believe that costumes are about moving the story along. Great costumes, you know, how people and vote on best costumes. You know, people vote with different criteria. There's no rule. And my criteria is costumes that help illustrate character and move the story along and really tell the story. Of course, you know, people look for just a scope of work on how big something is. That usually gains a lot of points, or how aesthetically pleasing something is, which is, you know, the pretty dress thing. So people vote for different reasons, and there's certainly no criteria other than just your own sensibility. But I am encouraged to be alongside such interesting character-driven films. And, of course, incredibly humbled and honored to be nominated for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, for sure.
As you were talking about this, so I guess we think about you talking about costumes moving the story along. And that's, I always thought one of the reasons they're called costumes is that because originally they weren't there to move the story along. They were there to create this kind of dream world and to be bigger. And because movie costumes for a long time influenced the way Americans dress. People put on suits and nice dresses to go on airplanes because they saw that in movies.
And that's a byproduct, right? I mean, our job is to tell the story, ultimately. And costumes are identity, right? So costumes are to tell the story, to illustrate the character, and give visual clues. Like if the sound goes out in the theater, you know, hopefully by their hair, makeup, and costumes, you can tell where they are, who they are, and, you know, what time period they're in. I also believe costumes, the job of a costume designer is to create a beam-me-up suit, if you will, for the actors, so that the actors can get physically into this costume and access that character, that time and place. It can be an assist, if you will. So the tactile experience of an actor putting a costume on, I take really seriously. And every actor is different. Some actors are not connected to their physical inhabitation of a character, and other actors are extremely connected to that. There's a quote I often refer to where Laurence Olivier, I had read in like some acting book when I was a teenager, where he said he started with his character from the shoes up. And, you know, that's a perfect guideline for a Tarantino movie, because as we know, there's a lot of shoe shots in our film. So in this movie,
feet shots too, but that's another conversation.
Yeah. Feet and shoe shots, which as a costume designer is awesome because most of the time, you know, you'll spend time and energy on what they're wearing head to toe, of course, and you never see it on camera. So I knew the shoes were going to count literally. But also that, you know, when Brad put on those moccasins and I was hoping to help him access Cliff Booth. When Leo puts on the cowboy boots that Rick Dalton wears, hopefully that's a part of a beam me up suit to access Rick Dalton and inform their posture and how they carry themselves. So costumes also have a physical assist as well for the actors. That's what I believe anyway.
As you're talking about this, I was thinking of something we've talked about here before, because I brought it up to you because I'm kind of obsessed with the way you do it, which is that the way outerwear defined your characters. I told you about the Ben Foster's jacket in 310 to Yuma, or Angelina Jolie's coat in Girl Interrupted. And that, too, becomes, I think, kind of a beam-me-up thing, because so often these things that you do along those lines are unique and built specifically for these moments. So it's not only that kind of moment that immediately locates the actor in the costume, but also gives audiences a minute to kind of think, wow, that's kind of cool, but it lends itself to that.
Yeah, well, you know, outerwear, like a lot of the way we arm ourselves, the way we, you know, the character's veneer to the outside world. You know, you see it with Rick, with his, he wears a lot of leather jackets, you know, when he's
Yeah, maybe
Rick.
Someday somebody will find an extra one to give somebody.
We'll have to make you one on the next movie, for sure. And, you know, we didn't have heavy outerwear Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, only because it's in L.A. and it's hot. And
but still, there's a denim jacket. There's that the leather jackets that Rick wears. I mean, there are enough of those kind of things that I think of as being one of your specialties.
Oh, thank you. It's a character layer. That's how I look at it. It's character layer. And if you think about how we all get dressed every morning, and we dress for, you know, it's our armor to the world. You know, it's who we want to present ourselves, whether it's for comfort or to look like a badass. Whatever your motivation is that morning, we make choices based on how we want the world to perceive us, consciously or subconsciously. So I try and create a backstory, which of, you know, Quentin was really into. We got a lot of backstory from Quentin on each character and why they would make these choices and what does that say about them. And that's really, you know, the process of figuring out the costumes. You know, Leo's character has over 30 costume changes. So once you get fluent in the characters and who they are and why they do things, then you can easily figure out, oh, that's, you know, that's his Chinese robe moment at home when he's, you know, practicing his lines for Lancer, or that, you know, you find these wonderful moments where you can help show a different facet to their characters.
I guess it's interesting, too, is I was lucky enough to be on the set one day, the Lancer shoot. And
I loved seeing you on set. That was a great day.
It's not a bad day for me either. By the way, that's what we're talking about. It's a set of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's costume designer, Oscar nominee, Ariane Phillips, sitting across from me. But to see that set was also about a world in transition. I mean, the Western characters are being outfitted in ways they hadn't been in Western TV shows before that, and the influence of movies on that. And then the director, Sam Wanamaker, who's wearing a turtleneck and a medallion. So he's in costume on the set. I mean, just the way that you were able to play with, again, and blur those lines between what's real and what's not, and the kind of way that people are trying to build kind of a fantasy version of themselves to be in a fantasy. I mean, that was... I'm so marveling at the amount of work that took to get all that in one place.
Thank you. I had an incredible team with me, and that was really fun. That was the beginning of shooting on the Universal lot. I was a nervous wreck. It's my first time with Quentin. And, you know, he has a wonderful family of filmmakers who have worked with him on multiple films. So I was a newbie.
So. But as you do tell me, it was a place where you were immediately comfortable, just because he wants his filmmaking to be about the pleasure that movies give him.
Absolutely.
And that's something that's communicated. But just sort of seeing your delight in having been able to do this, and just watching the look on your face as you were watching all these people coming in and out, was kind of thrilling for me.
Yeah, me too. I mean, you know, Quentin was on my short list of directors I always wanted to work with. I'm a huge fan, seen every single one of his movies more than once. And I never really imagined I would be there. You know, I never imagined I would be there. And the way that things worked out to be able to be there, I really had a lot of gratitude and a lot of fun. And it was nerve-wracking. It was such a big show to harness. There's so many different sets and characters and sub-stories and, you know, crossing storylines that it was a lot to harness and really daunting. But when you're in it, I mean, I have the best job in the world. I feel so, and it was also incredibly gratifying to be able to be supported by such a group of incredible filmmakers behind the camera. It's kind of the fantasy I had, I guess, when I was a young person wanting to become a costume designer. I kind of thought it would be this great communal experience. And sometimes it is, and a lot of times it's, you know, just the challenges and the struggles of the day. And there are these moments on Quentin's set where I really had these kind of pinch me moments of like, you know, this is the way that, you know, they used to make movies. This is the way that, you know, and I'm just talking like 10 or 15 years ago, like pre-digital. And, you know,
Quentin's shooting on film.
Yeah, Quentin shoots on film. We have dailies, you know, where we show dailies every couple of days, and then towards the middle of shooting, he would show dailies once a week, and everyone would come from the grips and the electrics to the, you know, to Robert Richardson, to Barbara Ling, to the cast. Leo would come, and it was like a party. We'd have, you know, food and drink, and that really ingratiates this wonderful camaraderie. He also did the same thing during prep. You know, he has a theater here in Los Angeles called the New Beverly, and it was closed for renovation when we were prepping the film. Every Wednesday, he had movie night where everyone was invited, and he showed films that were filmed in Los Angeles around 1968 or 69. We saw like Paul Mazursky's Alex in Wonderland, Bob Carroll, Ted and Alice, Model Shop. And that was super fun to watch movies with Quentin. And he would come over and like whisper in my ear, like, you know, I love it. Robert Colt's wearing
the white jeans.
Yeah, exactly.
We've had these conversations before.
Yeah, it was super, super cool. And it was so amazing. The crew that would show up for those screenings, there's this cowboy, like the first one, there's this cowboy sitting in the back and a bunch of people. This is early on in prep. I remember saying to someone, who's that guy? Oh, that's the horse. That's Scott, the horse wrangler who's worked on, you know, Hateful Eight and Django. And I was like, that is incredible. That guy, like, you know, he came from, you know, he doesn't live in town, him. And, like, everyone was there, Grip and Electric. So Quentin really involves everyone in the process. He loves making films so much.
What was it like for you the first time you saw the film?
It was emotional. I'll be honest. When Margot at the Playboy Mansion, when she's skipping with Mama Cass and Michelle Phillips, I got really choked up. And I realized that, you know, watching Margot inhabit Sharon Tate in this beautiful way of really communicated the innocence that I felt was permeated our culture at that time, pre-tragedy. And Marco really embodied that in a way. I really had this, like, I was super surprised, this emotional release. And I think all the research that had gone into reading about, you know, I only really knew about Sharon Tate in her death. I mean, I had seen some of her movies, you know, I had seen Fearless Vampire Killers and Wrecking Crew and Valley of the Dolls, but I didn't know a lot about her as a person. And I really got to learn about Sharon while making the film with her sister, Deborah Tate, was a consultant. And of course, I got to know about her, and that underscored with doing all the research around the Manson family. You know, I guess I compartmentalized it. It was just, it's really heavy stuff. And, you know, there are many films I've worked on that have kind of a dark aspect to them, but nothing quite like this, a tragedy that is part of our culture that really represents so many things, and of course, learning about Deborah Tate and her family's personal loss affected me. And I think, so when I first saw the movie, that was overwhelming. And it was an emotional reaction of pride that, you know, Margot was able to really do such a beautiful job and represent kind of what I was feeling of this beautiful woman who also was about a time and a place. And I was enraptured. I've seen this movie more than any other film I've ever worked on. And every time I see it, I see something different. And even though I worked on it, you know, I mean, I've seen it 5 times. I'm sure I will see it 5 more.
No, I'm going to have to ask you to come back because we're out of time. Well, you're welcome back here anytime.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, Elvis. It's an honor and a pleasure. I love seeing
you. Sure, it's neither of those things, but it's been a busy week. Congratulations again to our guest, Ariana Phillips, the costume designer, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Recording engineer here at NPR West is Josh Newell. The show is mixed and edited by Kat Yore. I'm going to go get some old shoes so next time I can be in one of Ariana's movies. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.